To go north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each episode for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to George R.R. Martin, Fantasy Flight Games, Card Game DB, and you, our loyal and new listeners. Check us out at www.whitebookpodcast.com and contact us on Facebook and Twitter, or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This CC licensed music is Townfish by Spinozar.
God, that's such bad writing.
It's cryptic prophecy.
Yeah, it's also like a teenager who just discovered what an opposite means.
So it's really written from Dany's perspective? Or
yeah, she'd be, what, 16 at that point? 17?
But she didn't prophesize herself.
No.
Well, that's right. That's true.
So that's who, Pietri?
No, I think it's Quaithe, right?
Yes, I think it was Quaithe.
Quaithe of the Shadows.
Indeed.
Well, she could be all kinds of teen angsty. We don't know.
Yeah, well, if you name yourself of the Shadows, I'm just assuming you're a teenage goth.
That's true. That is very true.
She does wear a mask. Lacquer mask, so.
Yeah, we have no idea how old she could be underneath.
They talk about the mask all the time. They never mention that she has a silver chair t-shirt on.
Her belt's from Hot Topic.
Yeah. Well, welcome to this week's of Teasing the Goth Kids in Class. We promise they're not going to hold a grudge for years, also known as the White Book.
Hi, I'm Aaron.
I'm Will.
I'm still Tommy.
I'm Roy.
And if any of our listeners are still in a goth period or decided they are just goth for good, no offense truly meant.
Is anyone really goth for good?
You know, I just kind of liked the phrase when it popped into my head.
It does have a little bit of a ring to it.
Yeah, I think it'd make a good
Amanda Palmer.
It kind of sounds like a charity organization.
It does.
Goths for good or something.
Alliteration is always good.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
So we have announcements.
We do?
You're such a teacher, Aaron.
Is that really that teachery? That's not even my teacher voice. I can't do my teacher voice on demand. It has to happen like, all right, whatever.
You have to actually have people to corral.
I don't know. Like, it's almost like a shilling announcer voice, my teacher voice.
Yeah. Oh.
I can do it in person.
To sell me a used car?
At least part of it.
Like, only part of the car? The tires?
Only part of the car. It's like, you can buy tires. All right, stop it. Announcements for the White Book website, whitebookpodcast.com. We have upcoming daily articles by luminaries of the community. We're pretty proud to announce that Mondays are going to be shared between alternating weeks. The Fitch That Wins, Boston Meta's leader, Lauren Fitch. Yeah, Boston Woo. Leader Brit, Lauren. And alternating with Lauren will be the second place in the World War of the Five Kings tournament, Wisconsin's Patrick Haynes.
Nice.
Patrick's great.
Yeah, super nice guy. Let's hope he can write.
His posts on Facebook seem very, very
well. Literate?
Yeah.
He's an articulate guy.
Yeah. Lauren, we know, can write. Lauren's sort of brilliant.
She's Dr. Fitch.
Yeah. All right. Tuesdays, we are getting something, like videos, like gameplay.
Doppler talk.
Like something from Greg Atkinson of Missouri. You might have heard of him as the creator of Flea Bottom and Knights of the Hollow Hill, a two-time world champion. The guy who co-founded this podcast, or this podcast's predecessor.
Yeah, sure enough.
Wednesday's article already debuted. It was Alex Kern of Tulsa, who's a fantastic deck builder, and me, Aaron. We did Two Guys, One Deck, where we have a conversation and build a deck in the process.
I really dug the conversational style. That was a nice format.
Yeah, we're sticking with it. He was like, should we make this an article? I was like, no, that's so much more work. I mean, no, it's so much better for for readers.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a nice change of pace. I doubt anyone else is going to have a setup like that, so makes it stand out.
It's kind of like Alex a, really a knows buddy what cop talking movie. About.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the vibe I got when I was reading it.
Nice. Okay. Alternating with us will be England's best Targaryen player, Nate Holmes. Awesome guy.
Yeah. I was pretty pumped that he messaged us and wanted to help out and do something. So we're gonna try to spread our scope a little bit. It's always tricky to schedule European guests on, or even Australian, or really any other continent other than North America. So getting Nate and another author I'll let you get to in a sec on here has me pretty pumped.
All right. Thursdays will first be building a meta with Roy Rogers. Say hi, Roy.
Hi. They somehow let me on both the podcast and the website.
People like Roy.
It's the name.
It is. It's a sexy name.
Too true. So how many cowboy hats do you own?
Well, that's chicken a little too personal of a question. All right. Little too personal of a question.
Meanwhile, the other Thursday writer will be the awesome Andreas Aldrin, who I called so on last week, and I apologize because I promised him I would, and I actually am sorry. I wasn't sure he played the same deck when he was mentioned. Andreas Aldrin is of the world-renowned Swedish meta. He's the one who should have won the Melee. Andreas will be writing an article about the European meta so that we get a more global perspective. Friday, there's this podcast you may have heard of or be hearing of right this instant. Saturday, you get a day off, listen to the podcast. And Sundays, we'll be updating our tournament winning deck list. We have 21, and we have in the queue about 5 or 6 more that will be being posted Sunday.
Nice.
So, it's a lot of content.
A lot of content. New game, new ideas.
Yeah, I'm pretty pumped Love for it. That. I'm sure not all these, as listeners at this point have already seen, one Wednesday article is up, but not the other. So it's going to be a little bit of a staggered release schedule as everyone kind of gets into the groove of writing here. So expect to see that content popping up and getting that regular schedule kind of locked down. As well with that, I want to reiterate the tournament and event listing software there on the site. We had a ton more submissions this week, which I was pretty excited about. We got several more international tournaments, so come by. If you're running an event or know of one that's not listed, feel free to go ahead and submit it so we can go ahead and get that on there. People can search, find what they're looking for. We have a handy dandy new calendar view as suggested by the Fitch that wins.
Ah, Lauren.
Yeah, yeah, which should make things a little easier. I have stripped a few things out of the menus and renamed a couple things to hopefully make it easier to find some of the key stuff as well. So come check it out.
Hey, and any suggestions you have for either content or if you'd like to contribute some content, please do let us know. We're always willing to listen to you guys. We do this for the community, so.
Yeah. By all means, drop a line in the comments here or on CardGameDB, shoot us a message on Facebook, or drop an email to contact@whitebookpodcast.com.
Oh, also something cool happened after last week's episode. I got like 15 people literally asking me for that Lanny Stark deck.
Oh. So,
yeah, that's going to be out there.
Nice.
People are like, I know you're still playing it, but can I have it? And I was like, well, shit, at this point, might as well. By the way, if you missed it, our missing co-host Kyle Vansel took that selfsame Stark Lannister Wolf deck and won one of his local tournaments with it. So
yeah, undefeated, I think I saw, right?
Yep, undefeated.
That's right.
Good job, Kyle.
Only Tommy can manage to lose with that deck.
Oh.
Haven't played it yet, but we'll see.
Well, hey, one other bit of upfront announcement news before we move on. Listeners, you still have time to participate in the meme contest. You have up through, I believe it was Monday the 14th for submissions. So be on the lookout for a gallery coming to Facebook after that. But before then, submit whatever funny Thrones or podcast related stuff, preferably winter themed, but not a requirement. And we're going to have one of the sweet Ygritte deck boxes riding on the votes once that's set. At least I think it's sweet. I really love that art.
And I will also still be sending my favorite playmat, so don't forget that. And in addition, just to top Beyond the Wall, since they're on hiatus and can't even answer us, if you get us to 1,000 likes on Facebook, and we got like 150 last week, which was pretty great.
Yeah.
So with 1,000 likes on Facebook, we will top Beyond the World and send you a world famous no prize.
God.
I love it. The classic. Are you going to send them that one you got from Marvel last year?
Exactly.
Nice. Well, there you go, guys. Aaron's willing to pass that right on to some lucky winner.
Dan Lee personally sent me a no prize.
Nice. That's going to be really terrible for the folks that don't get that joke. Go Google it, listeners, if you don't.
No, don't put that part in. Cut that.
You should read Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, which is a wonderful book about the history of Marvel Comics that tells you all about the no prize.
I actually read that.
It's a great book.
Yeah, over like 4 days, I devoured it. Okay, next up we have a list. We know how you guys do love lists. This is not an ordered list, but it's 10 cards that define the meta, but not just define the meta, they're 10 cards that you absolutely cannot fold to. If you bring a deck that folds to one of these cards to a major tournament, you are probably going to be in trouble. You need to have answers and be aware of these 10 cards.
All right. I'm curious to see what these cards are. I have not even looked at the list, even though you dropped it in the chat earlier. Want this to be fresh so we can rebut and mercilessly ridicule you for your choices.
And okay. To that end, Aaron, let's count these down backwards from 10 to 1.
They're in no order. I'm going to try and make up an order as I go in my head, but it's like I'll try and go from a little bit general to a little more specific.
Okay.
So you have to absolutely be ready for treachery. And I know that's hard because it's an event that stops so much, but you can't have just one trigger that your deck entirely relies on or treachery will end your world.
That's true, actually. You know, I hate to have to do that so early in the game here, but treachery is just a game breaker. It's interesting, though, I think, looking at that like as much as you can bluff in the game now with the usage of gold for events and such, but also there's so much information on the table now, particularly with an event like this for Lannister, where you have two different factors that you can tell at a glance, you know, whether they're able to play it at all, whether they have the unique or the gold. So, I don't know, you still have to play around it, but it's one of the easier ones to account for the possibility at a glance at the board.
And treachery is also one of the cards that answers many of the other cards that are going to be on this list. So it sort of is in an interesting place in that respect. I think it's also the easiest. I mean, it's good that Aaron started here. So it's the easiest to play around. Like, I mean, particularly in second edition right now, it's, I think, very hard to build a deck that collapses entirely to treachery. But actually, I think as the card pool expands and people become more and more in love with these huge combos and make treachery is really going to be a threat. So it's definitely something that it's a core set card that is always going to be a threat, and it's a threat that's going to grow exponentially.
So let's look at it this way. Of your triggers, take the entire card pool right now and say, what are your triggers that most devastate you if they're hit by treachery? I mean,
right.
That's half the rest of the list.
Exactly. That's actually really not a bad point at all. But I mean, the first one that should come to mind is Varys.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
If your Varys gets treacheried, I mean, that I think that setting up your Varys, that's the place where you have to be the most mindful about treachery.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, let's keep going with events. There's two more events on the. Oh, three more events. So let's take the next event. And it is Tears of Lys. It is when you win an entry challenge. As an attacker, you can play it to put a poison token, which will kill a character without an intrigue icon. A lot of decks are built around these giant beat sticks that don't have intrigue icons. And whether it be Catelyn, whether it be Little Bird, whether it be help me with the Barra card that gives an intrigue icon. Selyse.
Yeah.
Whether it be Selyse, you need to make sure that you're not going to get, your opponent's not going to see a Tears turn one or two and then immediately end your game.
You know, it's interesting because maybe it's just because I tend to myself play the houses that can use Tears. I'm finding its effectiveness like drastically down lately, and I kind of considered maybe I cut it to make room for something else because everybody's account right now, you know, first turn my opponents always have Selyse or drop the little bird on Asha or whatever, and like I'm starting to think maybe that space I could use somewhere else for now.
Little birds are completely out of fashion here, so it's almost the opposite. It depends on your meta.
Interesting.
It's also a card that is, I think, going to get worse as the card pool grows. Once we start getting good, other good 5-costers, other good 6-costers, other good 7-costers.
I disagree.
When your bomb card, you know, there's going to be more bombs as the game expands. And so, you know, losing Asha, that you don't necessarily, I don't know, have, I don't know, what's a spoiled other impactful Greyjoy character? The Reader. That's just one point off there. You know, to fill a spot, to push challenges through, to get to your win condition. In a way in which, right, if you lose Rob, you know, if you lose Bob and you're playing, you know, Baron Neal, you're fucked right now.
But you can, to an extent, build around Tywin, where building around Bob even now is a little more dangerous.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes Tywin so good and such a, you know.
He's an entry icon.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he's more steady. I think the risk reward with Bob is enormous.
Right.
I mean, because Bob can own Tywin if you protect him properly. He can easily overwhelm Lannister, but he's just harder to protect.
So I think, and this is a bit of an assumption. This could be. I mean, we know we're getting the icon removing attachment. So I'm assuming icon removal is still going to be a thing, and I think Tears of Lys is going to have a home in many a deck as long as icon removal has a home in many a deck.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. I mean, as icon, you know, if really icon removal is a Martell theme that Nate and Danny are interested in pushing, and it seems with the attachments they are, you know, there's a great feeling. The play right now of, you know, confining Tyrion and Tearsing him is a really satisfying play, and that's just going to expand, you know, pretty soon. Tywin is going to be available to be Tears of Lys with if you get an icon attachment on it.
All right. Next up, next event is Put to the Sword. You're going to lose military. You need to figure out how to, as much as possible, when that condition is in effect, not let that be by 5. That is, I think, the single most important part of maintaining a military presence right now.
I definitely agree, but I really want to know from the three of you, like, I've found so far, like, Put to the Sword, unless you're truly behind in the sense that you only have a claim soak and one amazing character, is the easiest, I guess, to eat. And like the way in which you have to be able to build your deck to know that if things are behind, you're going to have to eat a Put to the Sword. And if you have one character that can't be put to the sword, you can't reliably dupe or reliably bodyguard, you know, your deck might not be in a place that's particularly good. But I definitely want to hear what you guys have to say.
It's the ultimate snowball card. It's the I'm pulling ahead, and this game could still go either way, but I just drew a Put to the Sword, and if you can't answer it, this game is not over.
It's a lot like playing a Fear of Winter. You know, you're about to turn the game and begin control, and then you just hammer that advantage. It's very much that feel to me, especially if you're able to pull it off on a claim 2 turn. I mean, you pretty much can watch your opponent scoop right there.
Yeah. I mean, the way the game is right now, that's very nearly a one-sided board wipe, and there's just not the ability to overcome that. Yeah, and then follow that with March to the Wall afterward, and
yep,
whew.
GG.
Yep.
And the card is ubiquitous. I mean, everybody's playing it, regardless of the house that they're in. I mean,
but the one drop.
Go ahead.
Right, but I mean, it is like I think the hardest, I guess, to bluff. You could say, since there's so many different sort of demarcations. Like,
I think it's the easiest, you
know,
to bluff.
I don't know, 2 gold plus they have to be able to push through 5 strength, and you know, if they attack with 6 and they know you can defend with 3, unless they're playing Tyrell.
You just over push. You throw that extra little bit until you save the 2 gold, and then you throw fucking everything into the military challenge, and they have to defend with everything, otherwise their game is over.
Yeah. And heck, I've even noticed a bunch of times just having the 2 gold, a lot of times people forget to calculate whether you can actually win by 5 or not.
Mm-hmm.
And so then everybody overcommits to that military challenge, and even if you're unable to pull off the Put to the Sword, you can still, things I do for love, to make your claim count even more.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, even without that, even if you just get regular military claim, you've effectively, if you're going first, not allowed them a lot to strike back with. And if you're going second, they had to account for that, and they couldn't go all in on their own challenges for fear of it. Yeah, it's nasty.
Well, it's definitely a nasty card, but I just feel it has more outs than maybe something like other cards that we're going to see on the list.
Sure, but I think the threat of the effect is almost as effective as the effect. That it has that win condition adds a whole nother subtext, a whole nother sub-level of play.
I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think that's pretty fair.
All right.
Okay.
The last event on the list, although there is another event mentioned as we go forward. The last event on the list, anyone want to guess? Because you should know.
The things I do.
Does it involve what? Fire and blood?
What?
No. Dracarys.
Yes.
Oh, shucks.
Dracarys. I straight up, if I have too much renown on a character, will not attack with that character if you have one gold and a dragon. Like if you have
probably good policy.
One gold and a dragon, and I have 4 power on Jamie is now just going to sit there and be like, well, guess what? I'm going to sit here with 4 power.
Just for my curiosity, is 4 like specifically your cutoff, or was that just a random number?
That was a random number. Although 4 seems about right. Like
that's kind of what I'm
fairly willing to chuck about 3. 2 to 3 is 2 almost certainly I'm willing to chuck just to get it out of the goddamn hand so I can play a game.
Yeah, and totally. 3 you can't the border. Just live in fear of it forever.
Yeah, but
I think Will's point though, you can't live in fear of this card forever though. Like there comes a point where you have to throw a good character to the dragons, and you see this if anyone was watching the somewhat poorly periscoped Red Saturday tournament where Aaron threw Tyrion into a Dracarys. I mean, Tyrion's a great character. He's useful. He generates resources. He's got stealth. He's got the right icons for Lannister. But Aaron knew that he had characters with renown that he needed to protect. He knew that as soon as you see one Dracarys, you know, he's only got 2 more. And the chances of him having those other 2 is very low. It was a really good play. It was a very smart play. As someone who could see Ian's hand in particular, it was a very smart play. And that's the sort of plays you have to think about. Like, what character can you throw to burn to open up play perspectives for yourself?
Right. So I had...
Go ahead.
At the time, I had Randall Tarly out. And Tarly actually, I think, had exactly 4 power at that point, or 3 power, something like that. And I was immediately pumping with Marjorie to make sure, like, even if I didn't get the stand, to make sure that he stayed alive. So it would have taken a double Dracarys to kill him. So getting 1 out of hand for Tyrion meant that he had to draw his next 2 Dracarys to stop me, which functionally wins me the game.
And we've been talking about bluffing. I mean, sometimes you got to just make him prove it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. But I do think Dracarys is also a card, though, that gets more powerful as the card pool expands, because the more burn we get, the more small burn, like, you know, if we get something that just does a seemingly banal thing like -1 on a character, well, that means any 5 strength character is vulnerable to Dracarys. You know, if we, you know, just the more burn effects, even if they're small burn effects that we see, even if they're in themselves not terminal burn effects, Dracarys becomes more and more powerful. And it's simply something that people...
It's going to assume that you're going to continue playing dragons that you don't care about using in challenges, that you're going to just have sitting around to do this.
Yeah, are you going to run 9 dragons at all times, or 7 dragons at all times, so you have that, so you can run those 3 events? Maybe. And, like, Dracarys is good enough that, like, I'm not entirely sure the answer isn't just, like, hell yeah, I'm going to run those dragons. But especially...
The dragons are cheap enough. Like, they're not like they're 7 cost dudes.
But right. Do you want to run 3 of each is the question. Not do you want to run dragons, how many dragons? Because you need to run multiples of the dragons in order for Dracarys to be reliable. And for the foreseeable future, for at least the next cycle, so... We are looking way too far in advance, but for at least the next cycle, it's hard to imagine that you're not going to want to run them that way. And that just means, like, Dracarys is going to be a board wipe for basically everyone but Tywin and Bob that we have right now.
Right. If we get better dragons, that could be, you know, as well, that the card still is a threat because, yes, of course, if we get dragons that have their own effects when they're in challenges, that creates more flexibility for Dracarys. You can run Dracarys, and if you don't see it well, you know that... Drogon is eating characters if he wins challenges or things like that. So I just think it's an interesting design, and I think it's something that definitely is going to be, I think, a meta steady for the life of the game.
I'm mostly happy they made the character have to participate in a challenge.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So much better than
Incinerate.
Absolutely. Incinerate's a 1.0 card that was, for those who don't know, where you can kneel and influence, don't worry about what that is, basically pay a gold, to name a trait, and you counted up how many tar characters you had with that trait, say lord or dragon or whatever, and they got negative strength according to that trait, and then they just died if they hit 0. Didn't matter if they were participating, didn't matter what they were doing. It was stupid.
It didn't hit uniques, though, right?
No.
Something that it didn't hit?
No.
No.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah,
it had to be in the challenges phase.
Right? Oh, no. It did. Sorry, I know what I was doing. I was conflating it for a moment with Illyrio. His burn effect didn't hit.
Yeah.
No. That the whole reason that incinerate was so dumb is that it had almost no restrictions.
Yeah. Well, let's not delve too far into reminiscing about a card that I'm not sure should have existed in first edition. What else do we have on this second edition list here?
Well, let's do the singular attachment. What's the attachment your deck cannot just lose to?
Probably Milk of the Poppy.
Yep. I don't think it's a great card anymore, but I don't think it's a great card because I think the meta has adjusted. I think that you have to be aware that this card is probably going to be played on your best guy, and you have to at least have Confiscation and hopefully something else to deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, I was hoping to get to Naysay a little bit more as we went through this list, but I'm not sure I can. I mean, everybody is kind of running that tech of one kind or another for Milk of the Poppy, so you're probably only getting a turn or two at best, but you still have to account for it.
So is this a card that you think will always be in the meta, or do you think it is definitely something that as a card pool expands and people start running, say, only 2x Asha and 1x other 5-cost Greyjoy, or, you know, Baylon gets somewhat outclassed and there's sort of a Baylon plus 2 other 6-cost Greyjoy characters?
Outclassed. But that's fine.
Right. You know what I mean, Aaron. Like, I'm just throwing examples out there. Like, if bomb characters get spread out throughout the cost curve, is Milk of the Poppy, you know, so if you Milk of Poppy Asha, that's great, but there's going to be another impactful 5-cost character coming out the next turn.
It's or gone something by the like end that. Of the first cycle. Like, gone.
Well, I think we're also already starting to see that there's going to be more ways to remove these types of attachments. I mean, Bear already got one with being able to pull Crescent with their Here to Serve plot, which isn't necessarily optimal, but if you're getting your opponent to burn their Milk of the Poppy on Crescent immediately, kind of solves part of the problem right there. You've already got the removal out of Viserys in Targaryen. Greyjoy has other options on how to deal with it. I believe they have a new fun card. Yep. So I think there's going to become more and more ways to deal with this kind of thing, and as long as the attachments are terminal, it's not going to be that big of a deal. But the prevalence of negative attachments, like the icon removers and stuff that we've seen coming down the pipe, I think that that's going to be bigger than it ever was in 1.0.
It's definitely true. The more negative attachments we get, things like the spoiled fishing net, the more Milk of the Poppy, I guess, in some ways, gets safer to play on someone. Because, I mean, what do you want to hit? Do you want to hit the icon stripper on your Tywin, or do you want to hit the Milk of the Poppy on your Tyrion? I mean, it's definitely, it gives your opponent more choices when they're confiscating.
Yeah, that's fair.
Definitely.
At some point, you're running out of non-setup slots, though, so that is a bonus.
Sure.
Okay, let's do the two locations next.
Some of those negative attachments we've seen spoiled, though, I feel like they're...
Tommy?
Like they're what?
Tommy?
Yeah, I was just saying that some of those negative attachments that we've seen spoiled so far, you almost look get them as I replace events in my deck. Event slots go to put these in because they're not terminal.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense, but I mean, it's finding the right balance, and that's a new thing for everyone, old players and new players alike, so let's see how it goes.
Yeah, it is.
I'm excited.
All right. Next up, I think this is one of the weaker cards on the list, but it's one of the cards that if you don't know how to play around it, you just immediately lose the wall.
Immediately, or you lose slowly over several turns?
Slowly and painfully lose, sorry. Thoughts on the wall?
I think it's definitely a card that people, and as someone who has recently been playing decks that abuse the wall, have really started to figure out it's definitely an abusable card that people immediately don't really understand how to play around. But it's so inconsistent right now that I definitely think it's probably the worst card on this list.
Yeah, probably.
But it can definitely run over people.
Martell.
I know, compared to some of the other cards on this list, I would say it's definitely weaker.
Yeah.
Because it has that built-in drawback that's sitting there on the card. You don't even have to think about, okay, if I can push through an unopposed challenge here...
Well, but you can't push through. You have to sneak through an unopposed challenge. Right. Like, there's only one card that pushes through an unopposed. That's Baylon, right?
There's the event. The Greyjoy event.
Sort of. Oh, the Greyjoy event, too, true. That card is so...
Robert's sort
of... Please stop running that, people.
You know, kneel their only guy with an intrigue or power or military with Bob, and then you get what you want.
So, Alex has been playing... Alex Hines has been playing wall decks for a while, and wins something like 85-90% of his games with them. Like, and I don't think it's just him being a good player. I think that there's ways to build them and ways to play them, but it requires a particular mindset and a particular playstyle. Like Dan Struhel at our tournament, playing Wall deck basically for the first time, went 4-2. Like, if you're that kind of player, the wall just eats what you want to do to beat it. It also, the other problem with the wall, or the other strength of the wall, is it's also really good against anything like a mini curve deck. Mini curve decks that just have no hope of getting through.
Yeah, that's fair. They don't have much in the way of the keywords needed to punch that through. They're trying to go wide around that, and that leaves a lot of room to just defend.
And it doesn't take that many cards for a wall deck to get to a board state where your options are cut down such that, you know, you're top decking to try and find answers to get your way through.
Mm-hmm.
Engine and arranging party can yep. really make your life miserable.
Especially if you have a Castle Black.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that's only, I mean, it's a small number of combos that are pretty easy to assemble. Yeah.
And the card I really wanted to put, but the wall is what I put, because it's the most important. But the Messenger Raven is so key to getting all that together. Like, if they get a Messenger Raven, or God forbid, two, and you don't stop that early, they're going to see every piece they need in your intro. Everyone forgets that the Messenger Raven is ridiculously key.
It is one of the best draw engines in the game.
It's really good.
Would you see a scenario where you're burning a treachery on the Messenger Raven?
No, but I've waited to key moments and used it on either Castle Black or the wall.
I could see situations where I would, you know? Mainly, I don't know, say I've got a Varus on the board that I'm planning on triggering.
No, that's fair.
Yeah, maybe even if they've got a big enough board and I'm planning on hitting with a Wildfire next turn.
I've used Tears of Lys on a Messenger Raven before.
Oh, there you
that's
go.
That's not a bad use of Tears of Lys.
It's funny.
Well, you're trading one gold at that point. It's not, you know, you're not getting usual advantage from it.
It's long-term card advantage.
You're cutting their card. Yeah, it's definitely long-term card advantage.
Yeah, it's a tough choice to make when they're sitting on a Raging Party, though.
It's true. But Raging Party can be saved by Aemon. Well, they both can be saved by Aemon, so
yep.
That's part of what makes
also fun, treacherying Aemon when they've claimed someone important.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But that's a trick people learn, I think, pretty quickly to play around. I think that only has to happen to you once, just like in first edition.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, Aemon is going to pick himself, and preferably with a dupe. And
yeah. The last location, which would be card number 4 on the list, guesses?
That's got to be Gaston.
Yeah.
The one that won Worlds is a good call.
It's a huge tempo play.
It's a gigantic tempo play, but even more than that, it means a Gaston deck means that if you built your deck around one character, you're in an awful lot of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Gaston decks destroy Danny.
It does pretty well against Barret, too.
Yeah. It's wildly entertaining against Greyjoy.
Greyjoy has a lot of targets. I mean, Greyjoy, I think, of the houses you just listed, I think, can wear down Gaston Grey. You know, like,
you hit
like Pop Asha, okay.
Well, okay. Here's how Greyjoy beats Gaston Grey. It uses Euron, and Euron's meh. So,
I like Euron, but...
Yeah, I like
taking
Euron.
It for yourself, then he's definitely seven. Changes the equation.
Yeah. But if you can... A lot of Greyjoy decks aren't running Euron anymore, so if you can keep Balon... Like, Greyjoy tends to have trouble playing its expensive stuff more than other houses.
I mean, so, definitely the one thing that's keeping them in check.
So you just keep Balon in hand, and they're like, crap, I can't afford them again, and you should win.
Yeah, I actually did that literal thing to somebody a couple of weeks ago.
Huh. Okay. Any other thoughts on Gaston Grey?
It's definitely a number one target for a treachery. I mean, that's an equally big tempo play. Like, if you treachery a Gaston, that's huge.
Yeah. Back to the thought that it just is an answer to so many of the other cards on the same list.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next up is a card that gives no shits about treachery that we've been talking about multiple times, Balon Greyjoy.
He's a great example of what you said this list was all about. You got to know how to deal with him. Have a good way in mind for if he hits the table, because he'll wreck your day.
He's everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, he's a prime milk target then, right? Like, that's one of the fastest ways.
Or a tiers target.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's, so I think the biggest problem with Balon, and everyone's running Seastone Chair, like, stop running through Seastone Chair. It's not a thing. It's not like, it's like fetch. Stop trying to make it happen. Just run one Seastone, maybe two, and if you see it, great. Don't build your deck around it. Good players are ready for it. There's answers. You just run attachments on the right things and you're screwed. But, the real fear factor of Balon is you get to like 8-9 power, and I know you can close the game immediately.
Yep.
So, like, Roy, did you see my game with Sean in New York? I don't know.
I did not see your game with Sean.
Okay. Like, I had complete control of the game the whole time, but like, I have to keep him low in power. Like, he ended up at 14 power just because, like, just keeping him one away from that power rush, so I could close when he made that big push. Because I knew once he hit like 10, the game's over. I can't possibly stop that.
Right. Short of milk, Balon is a hard card to stop, I would say. But he can be a card that you can slow down, and oftentimes just giving yourself the breathing room. You know, this is Dennis Harrison of DC and I tested a lot for Red Saturday, and one of the things I found in the Greyjoy matchup, particularly Tyrell, if I could just force him to use Balon in a suboptimal way, I could create enough space for me to close the game out. But if he was ever, you know, particularly once you get that great Kraken Balon combo where he can, you know, stealth past, you know, Randall Tarly, leaving you with no one who can really get over him without a significant amount of work on your end, it's really hard to stop him. Short of milk.
The thing about him really is that so many different things synergize with him. It's the Iron Fleet Scouts that synergize him, the Great Kraken that synergizes with him, even beyond that it gives him stealth. Every little bit of stealth makes him a little bit stronger. And then, whatchamacallit, the Seastone Chair, which isn't great but is still good, synergizes especially well with him. That's a lot of things that go with that particular character.
And the thing that's frustrating about them, those cards, is they're also good on their own. Yeah. If you don't see Balon the whole game, you don't cry. See, you know, the pump warships. You know, Seastone Chair with Asha can be a very effective card. Like, that's what I think makes Greyjoy such a tempting house for so many players, is its combo pieces aren't full-on combo pieces.
They've got a lot of redundancy in some of the key cards, like you said, to push that, the Balon, the Asha, heck, even Theon's stealth at just a 4 gold investment can push that.
Even the Maester stealth can really get out of control towards the end of the game, like very powerful at the end of the game.
They probably have the second most redundancy after Vera.
Speaking of Vera, the number two card on the list is a Braithian card. We all know it. We all love it. It's Melisandre. However, with Melisandre, I am especially cheating. Melisandre is broken as is. She's fantastic in a corset environment. But that they put her with Scene in Flame is just crazy sauce. Because you can cancel one and not cancel the other.
Yeah, like, that's true.
Hands, Judgment, Scene in Plays, and your guy is still kneeling. They can see in flames and take your treachery away so you can't cancel Mel.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's a fun play, I have to say.
When you're the one doing it?
Yeah, when you're the one doing it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, from a design perspective, what's interesting about Vera and Greyjoy is how, you know, much Nate made those synergies sort of so obvious and closed loop in a way that it really does. I think, though, it's good that we have this on the core set because it shows new players like what a synergistic deck, what a thematic deck, what a deck built around a certain strategy should look like, even if it is really quite obvious in a way that I don't think any of the other houses besides Greyjoy and Vera got right out of the box. Right. Like, I think Tyrell's the closest, but Tyrell's still a little wonkier.
But how does Targ not count? It's like, hey, Danny,
that's hard, that's true.
Play shit with Danny.
That's their only theme. Mel is, though, she's powerful, but, you know, once you played a few games against Baron Neil and Baron Fealty, which I think is why really good players, except Sandy, have moved away from the Baron module.
Good because, players. You know, once... Except Sandy.
Once you played enough reps with a deck, you can really see, okay, how can this deck get around Baron Neil? And it's much easier than it really seems to those first few NPE experiences.
I still think it's a top three deck.
Oh, it's definitely a great deck. Don't get me wrong.
Not great.
But there's a reason why you...
Top three. One of the three best decks in the game is Barfield. Like,
but there's a reason why there wasn't that much of it at Red Saturday.
I mean, yeah, because people moved on, but not because it wasn't still kicking ass. It just won Stalic, didn't it?
Is that the deck that won Stalic?
Yep.
I really did follow the 2.0 Stalic.
Yeah.
It just won Stalic. Like, it didn't win New York because no one played it, not because it wasn't, like... It's still a competitive deck. It can still win any tournament. It's just, it's not, like, players, and especially in a new game, are trying out new things. And people sort of moved on from Vera Fealty. No? Okay. Yeah. Ready for the number one card?
Yeah, let's hit the number one.
You should all know what the number one card is.
The Red Viper.
Yeah, clearly. In first edition. What's the number one card? It's a character.
It starts with a V, right? It's a plot?
You're half right. It's Varus. People, you should be playing Varus. If you're not playing Varus, start considering Varus. You will come to a point where an opponent just starts seeing cards, seeing economy, and plays everything out, and you can just drop the Varus and win.
Yeah. He is our reset right now.
He is our only reset right now.
He's our possibly our best reset right now. I'm not going to go with only.
I am.
I think both of them are great to have together, that being Wildfire. But that may dig a little bit more into the next segment if I get into that topic.
Varus is meat of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's a big investment, which then, of course, to bring back to Tommy's much earlier point, really sucks when it gets treacheried.
When he gets treacheried, when he gets put to the sword, when he gets milked, when he gets Dracarys, and you know what actually happened to me once? He got Like Warm Rain.
Wow.
Yeah, I lost that game, and I was like, oh, wow, Like Warm Rain is a card. I should have known that exists.
It's definitely a card that they printed.
I mean, it's not a card a lot of people are playing, but it's a card they printed.
But it'll be around a lot more once that big box hits.
Probably, if there's enough direwolves.
Yeah. And but we already have direwolf attachments, and direwolf attachments don't work with it.
I know. So, that's a little frustrating.
Let's see if we get more direwolves or more direwolf attachments.
Oh, I'm sure we will. We haven't quite seen all of them yet.
Who are we missing?
Shaggy Dog, Nymeria, a Stark Ghost.
Yeah, yeah, we can see
that. They said we're getting a Stark John in the box.
That makes sense.
And I would assume they're going to do the same thing they did in first edition, where you get an attachment and a character version of each.
That'd be pretty cool.
It would be.
Yeah, I could get behind that.
Because we've only seen the attachment version of Lady so far, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. On to the next segment, Mr. Lentz.
Are we really done with Varus?
Is there anything else to say about him? He's awesome. Run him. Stop going. I don't know if he really has that much of an impact on the board. Yes, he does. Play him.
Right, you either play him or you build your deck to survive him. Like, you can build a deck that can survive a Varus and you don't need a Sunny.
Yes.
It's like you really, really load up on the dupe trips?
Build a deck with enough draw so that you can maintain a hand. Varus isn't a loss if you can play out other shit.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of the trick, though, is, maybe not the trick, but that all the houses are on relatively even footing with the draw.
Yeah. I don't know if that's true.
Relatively. There are a couple that I feel are worse off, namely Martell and Stark.
And Targ.
But, you know, their insight character at the 7-cost Danny point, though, is infinitely better than, say, the 6-cost Doran and Martell.
Yes, or Bran.
Oh yeah, I've got the Maester.
Forgot about Bran.
I mean, at least if Stark, running Stark Fealty or Stark No Agenda, you know, Gates of Winterfell is a solid draw engine, reliable. But like Targ, if you don't see Dany or you can't get Dany going, what do you draw with?
Or you run
Littlefinger?
Yeah.
Or Counting Coppers?
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of sucks.
And by kind of, he means totally.
Yeah, I was being nice. Martell at least has the traitor, which is very good.
I mean, the traitor is good, but I mean, they've got
still
that
enough.
That's playable.
Yes.
And that's basically it. You know, Sunspear can help kind of offset and generate you some card advantage, but if you're talking about some of that side stuff, Plaza is way better to do that type of thing out of Targ than Sunspear is, I feel, IMO.
Yeah, the worst draw is Martell, without any question. And then you're arguing between Stark and Targ, and neither one has very good draw. And then Tyrell has amazing draw, as does Night's Watch.
Yeah.
And Lannister has pretty good draw, and Bannister has one great draw card, but if you don't see it, you're kind of...
Bannister?
Really.
Did you mean Baratheon?
Yeah, that's totally what I meant. I don't know.
Well, I mean, they have one great draw card, but it is a great draw card. I think they are doing very well as long as they hit that.
Every other major draw house has at least two.
Yeah. I mean,
Lannister has three. Tyrell has only two, but they're freaking incredible.
Wait, what's Lannister's third? Got the location and the Archmaester.
The other location that just came out.
Cersei's
Wheelhouse. Yep.
So,
no, I think Lannister has redundant draw, which is really nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
And same with Tyrell. I think Tyrell is the strongest draw house right now. Oh, and Greyjoy. We're forgetting Greyjoy has good, solid draw. And we'll just get better when the
one draw card. Although they're
it's a really good draw.
It's a very good one.
Yeah, okay. Let's move on to your tournament, Mr. Linz.
Yeah, we did get a little sidetracked from the Varus discussion there. So
look, Varus draw.
Varus equals draw.
They are linked concepts.
They are.
Varus equals a need for draw rather than just playing more.
There you go. That seems valid.
And draw equals win, so draw stops Varus, so Varus equals a loss.
But he's a softer form of punishing overextension than other forms could be.
Than one form could be.
Okay, so on to the tournament, though. Keep the episode moving on. It was just a local event. It was our fresh meat tournament, as we called it, to kind of kick everything off here for second edition. So it was our first local second edition tournament. We had 10 players show up for that. So it was pretty solid, about half and half, old and new players. Greg and Corey, maybe of note, Corey that appeared on the show with Aaron and I a couple weeks back, as well as some new guys and some returning players. So it was a good time. Took this deck that we had built on the podcast previously and was very happy with its performance over the day. Wound up going undefeated in the actual tournament and then in a side match afterwards. So enjoyed that. Faced off against what did I play? A Greyjoy Tyrell and then a Tyrell, I believe it was Lannister, a Targ Fealty, and then for the final round, Corey and I faced off and he was running, or I guess I should also specify for listeners that care, the Targ Fealty was Greg. Felt good to beat him. And then last round was against Baratheon Martell.
I do love Baron Martell.
So you beat Greyjoy and Baratheon, and did you say Targ? Sorry.
Yes, and Targ Fealty.
So how did those are, I think, the three key matchups. How'd those three matchups go?
Well, I kind of want to start with the Targ Fealty matchup, because that is actually the one that I alluded to a little bit earlier with the Varus and Wildfire business, where turn one, Greg had a nice setup with a couple of the reducer characters and this, that, and the other, pushed on through that and probably had five or six characters on the board by the end of the first turn. Thankfully, we did have Wildfire in our plot deck after that discussion as we debated there, and I had the Varus in hand on my opening turn. So I just made sure I sat on the resources to play the Varus, hit him with Wildfire at the start of second turn. He went ahead and played out a bunch more stuff when I had him go first that turn. He, by the end of that, he must have had like seven characters on the board, hatchlings and Jorah and whatnot. He, if he'd been pacing it, he had a really nice assortment of stuff he'd drawn so far. But then I was just able to drop the Varus after baiting him into flooding the board again, wiped out his board from there, and for the rest of the game, basically, he wasn't ever able to afford to drop more than one character a turn. So there were actually even a couple turns where he did not play a character because he could spend seven gold on Daenerys and then watch her immediately die to military claim, for instance. So I was very happy to have both.
So did you think that Varus synergized well with the intrigue module that we spent all that time working on, or was it really Varus himself that was what decided that game?
You know, I think the intrigue module in general was good, especially in that game. I think it helped me keep that pressure on Greg after that initial kind of blowout turn. Because I did also have a Cersei that I played after popping the Varus. So he just really didn't have the safety to even, say, hold that Daenerys till he drew a hatchling or something to eat a military claim and kind of just keep him off kilter on both fronts. So I was very happy with the intrigue module in kind of a nutshell there. I never wound up really drawing Hand of the King often enough as I might have wanted to use it. The game I did draw it, I dropped it on the Tywin to close out the game with some extra renown challenges. But I did see Illyrio essentially every game, and using him to power multiple intrigue challenges from Cersei, just, I feel, sealed the deal at the end of that game, and definitely over the duration of my game against Corey's Barrow Martell, turn after turn after turn. So, you know, I really do feel like the two worked out well together, so well that I would actually like to go up to a second copy of Casterly Rock in the deck, because the games where I got Casterly Rock out, I felt things shift in my favor very quickly once I had it.
That's interesting that you mentioned about the Seal of the Hand. That was one of the three cards that I really wanted to ask you how they performed for you. And, I mean, you said that you hardly saw it, so it wasn't really a good sampling. But based on the use you got out of it, you probably would have liked to have seen it more, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's one I would actually be kind of tempted to go up to a third copy of it. I don't know. It's kind of expensive, I still say, from when I did draw it in that game. I kind of had to hold off playing it for a turn or two to secure some other things on the board. So I don't know if I would go up to the third. It was nice to have, but as far as the stand effects go, I think Illyrio was really where it was at.
Yeah, the cost has always been the issue for me with that card, but I do love the effect, absolutely. The other two cards I was curious about were the Queen's Assassin and the Counting Coppers.
Yeah, the Assassin, I feel like, too, did turn out to be the right number. I really tried to slow myself down and not make the goof I had made in pickup games where I had more cards in hand prior to playing the Assassin, and then the same number once I had him out of my hand. So I never did that during the tournament, but it definitely helped. Anything to help put extra pressure on their board after I had cleared out their hand, I think, was really good. And since I was really hurting for multiple claim plots, he was one of my better options to try to do that. To follow up the Counting Coppers, I also definitely liked this deck, maybe more than any of the others that I've played around with lately. I really did feel like there was that spot about three quarters, maybe 80% of the way through the game, where I had a strong enough handle on what was going on that I didn't feel like I needed a plot with more gold to get a board presence or anything like that. I just play the Counting Coppers, keep my hand full, and keep the pressure on that way.
And that was the question, if it was ever a gold issue. Because, I mean, my experience with Counting Coppers is kind of been the same way. If I've got a firm board state or I have control of the game, I can use the Counting Coppers to hammer home the win. But if I'm trailing, it's awful.
Yeah. And that's something I've always been kind of worried about. But in this deck, just never really wound up, I don't know, in that position I was afraid of.
Cool.
Okay. So Cersei's Wheelhouse, does that belong in the deck?
You know, that's that one. I was happy to see it in the couple games I saw it, but I'll tell you, the amount of times I triggered it, I think were just twice all day. I mean, and I grabbed an extra card, but that was basically it. I don't overall feel like it was pushing my opponent's choices very much or nudging them. So, you know, if I was cutting something for some other different card advantage, that might be a spot I might look at for that second Casterly Rock.
All right. Support of the people.
Yeah, that was one I really wanted to hit on as we were discussing here, because I played the deck, the exact same deck I posted on CardGameDB, so it was 63 cards, and it needs trimmed down. And I'll tell you, my very first candidate for that is going to be the two copies of Support of the People. It just did not pull its weight. I didn't play it all day, though it was in my hand multiple times, and I could just never, even after we skewed our icon when we were talking about it, and the like 37.7% of the icons in the deck, nearly as much as there are intrigue icons at 39.3, I just never quite had the strength I needed. Most often the power icons I had spare were Cersei or Illyrio, who came in just shy of ever actually letting me trigger it.
Almost like I told you that was going to happen when we were building the deck, but okay.
Yep.
Put to the sword / tears, fine at 2 each?
Yeah. I think those were perfect at 2 each. I saw them just about the time I needed them each game, and otherwise they didn't clog anything up.
Things I do, no problems playing it?
No problems. Didn't get it canceled all day. And
weird.
Somebody, I forget now who it was, I had actually discarded their hand's judgment the turn before I played the Things I Do for Love. So it was floating around, but I only remember seeing it that one day, or that one opponent. So otherwise, it's just perfect for this deck. It almost exceeded expectations for how well it let me kind of control challenges and board states and pop things back into their hand to strip out with Cersei.
Widow's Will.
Military icons?
Actually, you know, I was worried that I was really going to feel the pinch on the military icons, but I didn't. I didn't that bad. Jorah was generally good for a couple military challenges before I would march him to the wall. And then other than that, Jaime or the Hound would kind of do mop-up work. It didn't play out where I was at a disadvantage there.
Widow's Will?
You know, I think I would probably be okay with going down to one on it. It was kind of instrumental in me sealing the deal on a key challenge against Corey right at the end of the day. But aside from that, not huge. So I think I'd drop one of them.
Only 3 more cards I have one specifically asked about.
Okay.
Jaime or 3?
Jaime?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like things were pretty good at 2. Like I said, as far as it went, military icons would have been what I was worried about and would consider going up to a 3rd. But I didn't feel behind there like I expected to.
Rattleshirt Raiders?
I would probably be fine with cutting it in our meta, as well to make a little room. I saw a couple milks, but they were timed in such a way that I could pretty easily just flip my confiscation next turn and keep humming along fairly well, maybe down a gold or two, depending on, you know, if they blanked my Tywin on their marshalling before I went or something. But there was never a spot like where I blew my confiscation and then they just immediately milked someone again or anything like that. So
that's just my dumb luck. All right. Lastly, I think, because the deck is now 59 cards, by the way.
Oh, uh-oh.
Varys, can we use a 3rd?
You know, if we just drop down to 59 cards, I think that would be a prime spot to tweak, would be to go up to the 3rd Varys.
Okay. I have an updated deck. I'm going to tell you numbers and see how you feel, if that's okay.
Sure.
So 35 characters. They are in alphabetical order because that's how ThroneCV does it.
Okay.
3 Cersei, 1 Drogon, 1 Pycelle. If you hear a number that you'd like more or less of, let me know. 2 Handmaiden, 3 Merchant, 2 Illyria, 1 Rhaegal, 2 Jaime, 2 Jorah, 3 Targaryen Loyalists, 2 Hounds, 2 Queen's Assassin, 1 Tickler, 3 Tyrion, 3 Tywin, 3 Varys, 1 Viserion.
Sounds great to me.
Attachments are now 3 Seal and 1 Widow's Wail.
I'm not 100% sold on the seal, but I'm willing to try it at 3 so that I see it more often, and I can gauge its impact a little better.
2 Casterly, 2 Lannisport, 3 Kings Road, 3 Rose Road, and 2 Western Fiefdoms.
Sounds perfect.
We put 2 tiers, 2 things I do, and 3 treachery.
I think we had 3 things I do in my version.
The original did.
Yeah.
Let's throw a third in, because I like 61 anyway.
Okay.
I think Aaron cut a things in his version, didn't you?
Maybe
he did.
And the last
thing... I would have thought you cut the Castle Rock, but it's sitting... I'm looking at your version that you published 12 days ago, and it's only 2 things.
All right, last thing we have is... I don't know if I can tag this as a... I can't tag this as a winner anymore. Oh, well. Although I can notes it. Okay, the plots. Were they all good? Any comments about anything? Maybe Calm?
Calm was fine. It was nice, kind of as you had brought about on the show, as far as being good to have another high gold plot. So it was fine there. I was able to use it against the Tyrell player and name, or no, sorry, I think it was the Greyjoy player, and name Power in the late game, so he couldn't try to squeeze a win out from under me on the last turn. So, I mean, it was okay, but I'm not super attached to it. Overall, I thought things flowed well. I didn't really miss not doubling up on anything. One marched and one wildfire seemed to play out, very well to push and pull where I needed it to.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments about the deck?
How are your setups, Will? That's...
I probably should have been tracking it. I think it was averaging 4 cards. So, perfectly acceptable in second edition, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The final question, I guess, would be that last match against Corey. How did the deck hold up, particularly the Intrigue module, I would say, hold up against Neil? Since I'm assuming the Barra Martell was using the Neil module along mm-hmm. with Confiscation and some of the Chud from Martell.
Right. And that was where Illyrio really shone. And I was just able to go like wide around him on those challenges. I did get Casterly Rock out so that he was stuck having to defend even more Intrigue challenges, or rather, I guess, eat them. He got Solis out so that he could, give Robert the Intrigue icon very early. And had Robert all game, but he just didn't get enough other stuff to back it up. I managed to pull Mel out of his hand in the late game when he was in a awkward position and got stuck with her. And so most of his Neil pretty much revolved around trying to use just Robert. Illyrio, that is, just kept standing back up. Anybody. His timing is so flexible. Of course, he wants to try to go first a lot of the times to try to use Bob, but then I get that option with Illyrio. Then he's stuck trying to defend with Bob, but that doesn't help him much either when I'm throwing the extra challenge at him. So, yeah, I think overall it fared very well. Illyrio gives you a lot of play against Baratheon.
My final question is initiative. Did you like the initiative in our plots that we picked? Were you able to set the tone of the game, or did you often find yourself sort of somewhat at the mercy of your opponent?
Initiative-wise, I was at the mercy of my opponent most of the time. On the Marched and Wildfire Assault turns, I would take it, and that's about it. I think maybe 50% of the time I had it with Confiscation, but... otherwise, we were flipping coins a lot. Plot decks looking very similar with noble causes and summons and things like that. So I don't know. I didn't get to dictate a lot of the game through initiative, but I didn't really feel that hurt me either.
All right. I guess the last question would be, will you play this again?
Oh, damn it. Before he answers that.
Okay.
Did we run a Game of Thrones? No, right?
No, we did not.
Do we want a game?
I mean, it might not be a terrible sub for Calm over Westeros. It would definitely serve some of those same points in slowing down Power Grab. Still doesn't get hit by naval superiority. Yeah.
Were you opening with Noble Cause?
It depended on the game. There were some I opened summons, some Noble Cause, and I think one Calm over Westeros.
Okay.
I don't know. Go back to that question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Tommy. Go ahead,
I don't know if I missed it or not. Did you mention that you had any issues with stealth?
You know, I was a little worried against Asha. She looked like she was going to cause some problems, but I managed to chew through her duplicates and saves. The extra intrigue claim let me get the saves out of his hand, and then put the sword and a Tears of Lys managed to take her and the dupe out. So
gotta do it.
Yeah. If I hadn't, she was really going to town, though, so it was kind of a race to get her taken care of.
Cool.
Well, did you think you had the options? Like, I mean, or did you think that was just luck that you saw those cards, or do you think maybe consistently you would be able to do well in the Greyjoy matchup? Or did you feel it was luck that decided that?
No, I think overall I felt pretty good about it. I've got several options to try and deal with her. Of course, it's not completely uncommon for me to count enough gold to be able to bounce her with things I do for love or just treachery her stand to try to keep her from going crazy for a turn, or use Illyrio to stand someone who was not stealth up so they could defend. I felt like I had a lot of play.
All right. Then let's go back to that last question. Will you play this deck again?
Definitely. Now that I've gotten to sit down and play a day with it, this is definitely one of the most fun that I've sat down with.
I think you should take a lot of solace that you proved Aaron wrong. Aaron said this wasn't going to win anything. So.
Yeah, there we go.
You know what? I'll take my support of the people argument because that's what actually upset me.
Props and flops.
Props to Alex Kern for carrying my ass in our new article.
Well, I mean, props in general to everybody that's contacted us or that we reached out to write and produce some extra content for the site.
Slops to small children bringing home sicknesses from their school.
I thought you sounded stuffed up.
Yeah, I've been sick as a dog the whole week, so yay toddlers.
Oh, boy.
Props to the upcoming, well, not super upcoming, but in about a month, tournament in New York City on January 10th, 2015. You may get a chance to see the White Book's own Aaron Glazer there. All right, so Aaron will be there. So you see, you can meet Aaron and I. Again, if you're in the greater New York area, it's at the Uncommons, which is in the Village. It's a great little store. We're going to be using the winter 2015-2016 kits with Fortified Position and the Templestone Knight and the really sweet old bear mat, which I'm sure Aaron will try to win with all of his heart. Because there's no Night's Watch mats that existed in first edition, so first edition players are going to want to grab.
That is actually not true, Roy. There was Night's Watch mat from Gen Con this year.
Oh, that's true. But that's kind of like a Bera rescuing Night's mat, right? Because I have that one.
Well, it's got the. There was also the Jon Snow, not technically a Night's Watch card, but there was the Jon Snow from, I think it was it the World Top 16?
Yes, that's right, Will.
Yeah.
Whatever. Props to the Dutch meta, again, because they don't get enough love. But yeah, I've got to prop the Polish meta after that, too. But props to the Dutch meta, because they gave me the coolest Night's Watch mat ever. It's like little Jon Snow at a brothel with the dragon.
Oh, yep, it's very cool.
So I have my Night's Watch mat forever. While we're propping, props to the Polish meta. Remember our good friend Skuzdal?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's on the Polish meta board, and he's being a dick there, and they're just enjoying mocking the shit out of him, because they're awesome guys.
Oh, lovely. Well, I want to throw some props out to superhero television in general. Been a little while since I updated just that corner of pop culture. I'm caught up at least into the current season of Flash and Arrow, just a few episodes into each. But I'm enjoying that. A few episodes into Jessica Jones, need to wrap that up. Just watched the mid-season finale of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which, holy crap, in about the first 5 minutes had like a heart-stopping incident. So, yeah, a lot of cool stuff. I prop them all.
Yeah, Jessica Jones is really great. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah. I want to prop Grasshopper Comics. They had there. It's a New York-based comic shop in Long Island. They had their holiday party, which they get like a bunch of comics creators. Alan Milgram was there, as mentioned earlier, assuming that didn't get cut up to Will. And, shit, I'm really tired. Joe Kelly was there, a few other people. Fantastic. They draw, people draw basically all day for free for whoever comes. There's a humongous raffle, but 100% of the profits go to a, they feed you. All the profits go to a children's, cancer hospital.
Oh, nice.
Kids for Christmas. So I go pretty much every year. It's a great time. A lot of really, really nice people. You sit around, have geek talk, get things drawn, and it's all for a great cause. So props, Grasshopper Comics. If you are anywhere around New York, please go support them. They're a wonderful family shop and just great people all around. We're listening to someone type.
Props to that.
Props to that noise.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I've got anything else.
I have one more prop.
Sure.
Prop to my girlfriend, Ala, who is sitting here visiting me from Philadelphia. Yeah, and she's playing Harvest Moon while I podcast.
Oh, nice.
Sorry, Ala.
Ala, Aaron, and Will say hello.
Not what I said, but okay.
Well, I've got a double prop. One is to Harvest Moon, which is a great game, and I hope she's playing the original SNES version.
I'll have to ask her, which one are you playing? A New Beginning.
No.
For the 3DS. She's on my 3DS.
Okay, that's nearly as good. The other prop reminds me of that because it's food related, and that is going to be to Peruvian food. Which I had again here now for the second time. Got to try some different stuff from a local place called Cafe Cusco, and it is delicious.
What'd you order?
We actually had it catered in at work, so I know one dish was a like a spicy goat tamale wrapped in like banana husks, which was really good, or banana leaves, sorry. And then the other was some kind of rice and pepper and chicken dish that I did not catch the name of, but they were both fantastic.
You like seafood?
I'm not really a big shellfish person, but normal fish I do like.
Oh, okay. Ceviche includes shellfish, but you should try ceviche.
Okay. I mean, I'm game to try most stuff out.
Any props or slops, Tommy?
Lining Kugel's Snowdrift Porter. If you guys haven't tried that, it's pretty good. My wife and I have been drinking quite a bit of that lately.
It's quality.
You've got it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Props to Darlene, by the way.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, just general props.
Yeah, that's a good call. General props to her. That can't hurt me at all.
Always a good idea.
I was at a fun mealy table with her at Worlds.
I will make sure to tell her that you guys say hi, and I'm sure she'll hear it herself if she listens to the episode. But.
Yeah, I prop my wife all the time when I started, and she doesn't listen. So.
Oh, yeah, Aaron. Bye-bye baby trips. How about props for that?
Yeah, bye-bye baby is fun. Hey, props to her for buying me Taco Bell so I wasn't bitchy at Bye Bye Baby.
You'll spend a lot of time there.
That's fine. Nice story.
Yeah, props to Carla in general. Carla's great.
Mm-hmm.
Look forward to meeting her one day.
Indeed.
Come to New York. Sorry. But we've talked everyone but Kristen. So
yeah.
I guess.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Props to the lovely Kristen who gets back from long trips and then still lets me podcast and has not murdered me for doing that. So props to her.
Yeah, Kristen was great. She was my first game at Worlds and smashed my face with great joy.
Nice. Hey, and then you closed off with second edition against me. So we
losing to both Will and Kristen. Yeah. That was the only synergy that came for me the entire Worlds weekend.
Uh-oh.
Womp womp. And that closes another chapter of the White Book.
Oh, what a danger zone.
Too double dipping.
Too perfect.
Players have to have one listening.
It's true. And Will does have the best radio voice of any of us.
So. Oh, yeah.
Oh, easy.
Yeah, I've been thinking about auctioning it off, so to speak, and putting up a listing on Fiverr, if you guys are familiar with the site.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
The sultry tones of Will the Lens, $5.
Exactly.
It's going to be a lot of pornography, you know that, right?
Hey,
I hadn't thought about that, actually, but hey, you know, I'll take the money.
Girl's trying to get you to record their voicemail message.
Read them lullabies or something.